Well, I already have eight names on the list. EJ, you're first, and Andrew, Andy Ferguson, and then Will, and Karen, and Adele, and Elizabeth, and Miranda, and Doyle, and and Molly. Anyway, EJ, you're up first. Pull the mic over and be sure the green light is on.
Let me just say that I have some other slides, and I thought I would leave you with this one. This is a redo of the George Washington apotheosis with Lincoln. And let me just show you one more. This is one of my favorites.
Oh.
This is from 1865. This was a postcard. So apparently Washington was ready to greet Lincoln when Lincoln came into heaven. So we can be happy about that. Yes, EJ.
Okay, thank you EJ, so much. I was hoping you'd have John Winthrop speaking with music behind him. That was that was fantastic. It's sort of several overlapping questions. The first question, which I'd love you to deal with, is how much of this is entirely opportunistic?
Yeah.
It is so striking that everybody uses this imagery for their own purpose. For example, when the Puritans changed their minds about democracy, was there any consciousness or admission that they were actually changing significantly from what their forebears had said, or did they just pluck these ideas out because they served the moment? Second question, Denis LeCorne, whom I find this very interesting French observer of religion in America, argues that from the beginning of our country, we've had this split between those who saw the founding as religious, tending to go back to John Winthrop and using that, and others who have seen the founding as primarily an Enlightenment project, given that the founders themselves were, many of them were deists and were deeply influenced by the founding. I'd love to see you grapple with that. And just the last point, which relates to the first, the Exodus story is a universally used story about liberation from bondage. Mm-hmm. Walzer's great book. Is there anything peculiar about our usage of it, or are we just in a sort of long global tradition in seeing Exodus the way we want to see it at a given time, given the struggles we're engaged in? But thank you for the talk, and thanks especially for those images.
So let me start with the last one first. I do think that there's something unique about the way that Americans have used the Exodus narrative, because I think, if we could go back to, think of that slide of Benjamin Franklin's proposed seal for the nation, I think that the national identity was wrapped up with the idea that America was recapitulating the narrative of the Israelites fleeing from bondage to freedom, which then, of course, somebody like Mariah Stewart or Phyllis Wheatley turned upside down and said, no, in fact, it's the white colonists who are the Egyptians and the slaves who are the Israelites in bondage. But I think that our understanding of the nation has really been influenced by this idea of Americans as kind of an exodus people. So I do. Every nation has its own sense of what makes it special. But I do think that this is kind of in the DNA of American history. On the first question about whether this is opportunistic, of course, there have to be people who are using it in an opportunistic way. But I do believe that there was a lot of sincerity about this, and that there continues to be sincerity about this. I occasionally, not that often, teaching at a place like Harvard Divinity School, and before that, University of Chicago, I occasionally have students who came from very conservative religious backgrounds, who have really been raised with an understanding of America as specially chosen, and they can be a little bit shaken up when they start to understand more of the history of the Puritans, for example, because they really see Puritans as a kind of biblical people from whom the nation sprung. So it's clear that there are leaders who use this in an opportunistic way, but I think that There have been many people in American history who sincerely believed it. And for the Puritans who are kind of reinventing their identity in the 18th century, biblical reinterpretation is happening all the time. We as a country did this in the 19th century when I think as a nation we decided that the Bible, you know, does not sanction slavery. So I think, you know, this kind of reinvention is common. And Puritans did a lot of biblical work to make that happen. There was a lot of close textual analysis. I find some of the close readings sort of funny because they're strained, but I think that they were sincere. In terms of the founding, this is a complicated question, and in some ways I would want to distinguish between the founders, who I think really were much more influenced by the Enlightenment, and the mass of ordinary people, many of whom held very strong Christian convictions. I think that the American Republic was founded at a unique moment in American history when Enlightenment ideas were really quite influential and strong. I am not one of those people, I meet them occasionally, who want to turn Jefferson into a devout Christian. He clearly was not. He was very skeptical. But I do think that founders like Washington and Jefferson and Madison, even though they had an understanding of the Republic as a place for the free exercise of religion, that they saw Christianity as politically useful because they thought that it inculcated morality. So even though they had their own doubts, they were careful about what they said publicly because, you know, the fear was that the American Republic would not survive. And what was going to hold it together? People needed to be moral. And so Christianity was held up as kind of the moral glue of the Republic.
Andy Ferguson, pull the mic up and
oh, there we go. You had that amazing graphic you had of the slaughter of the Indians. I can't remember what the battle was.
I can go back.
You'd said that Winthrop thought that Indians were outside of the circle of people who could be saved. But you'd also said that they had Indian allies who were part of this battle, and obviously through the centuries there's been fervent missionary activities among the Indians. So did they distinguish between, you know, good Indians, bad Indians, Indians who were capable of being saved, Indians who weren't?
Yeah. This is really a tragic story. Puritans did try to evangelize Native Americans, and they had some success. So John Eliot was linguistically gifted and learned the Indian language. At Harvard Library, you can see his translation of the Bible, where he was trying to evangelize Indians. The Puritan relationship to Indians was complicated in the sense that even the seal of Massachusetts Bay has a picture of an Indian saying, "Come over and help us." So there was this idea that they were going to try to evangelize Indians. But there were immediately conflicts over land and territory. And so Puritans made some allies with Native Americans, but they also remained suspicious. So there's a wonderful text that John Eliot and some other ministers published. It was published under the title Tears of Repentance, where there were a number of Native Americans who were converting to Christianity, and so they were supposed to give testimonials to their conversion. And when you read the testimonials, if you've read Puritan conversion narratives, they sound pretty much exact to me. I mean, the Native Americans have really mastered the language of what it means to be Christian. But the observers there are highly skeptical, and they keep insisting that things be repeated. They face a lot of questions. So there's a kind of skepticism about whether they can really be converted. And where I think we see this most dramatically is in King Philip's War in 1675, 1676, which in terms of the number of people who died was the bloodiest war in American history. There was a huge percentage of the colonial population that was killed in that war. There were Native American allies who were on the side of Puritans, but Puritans didn't trust them. And so they actually interned them in Boston Harbor on Deer Island and did not take very good care of them there. They were, you know, close to starvation. But even with Native Americans who were so-called praying Indians and who had settled in villages, they were really seen as a potential threat, and there was a fear that they would, you know, sort of go back to their Indianness and attack whites. So they were interned, and some of them, you know, there were suspicions about some of them being spies, and those Native Americans were sold into slavery into the West Indies. So it's a complicated and tragic history.
Did David Brainerd have a better reputation?
So David Brainerd, it was in the 1740s. So this is, you know, say 50 years later. And, you know, by then, I think Native Americans were in a much weaker political position and military position. And I think Native Americans were even more interested in creating alliances with the colonists. Brainerd definitely had a better reputation among Native Americans, and so did Jonathan Edwards. But by then, certainly Native American resistance had not been crushed. This would not happen until the American Revolution, and really not even till after that, but in New England. It was during the during King Philip's War that white colonists really gained the advantage over Native Americans in New England.
Okay. As a moderator, I can jump the queue every now and then. Will Salatan and then Karen. Pull the mic up. Be sure the button is on.
Talk full of so much interesting information and insights. I wanted to follow up on EJ's question about opportunism, which I think a lot of us felt. It was such a survey of people appropriating this imagery and these ideas. And I was trying to think of how to put some meat on that question. And I guess there are two themes that run through your talk that go together. One is chosenness and one is covenant. And the chosenness is easy, right? The chosenness is the opportunistic part. Whatever we did is chosen. We are chosen. You're claiming God's authority for whatever you do. And covenant is the hard part, is things you have to do, things that constrain your behavior. Can you give, I guess, an example of a time or a moment when there was perhaps a debate where the covenantal part of this, where Scripture was invoked to constrain what people wanted to do, even when they wanted to do it in the name of God, perhaps when a movement changed its mind. I mean, emancipation would be the obvious example, but where people actually had to turn around or were stopped by other people using the power of religious belief and not just the belief that one was authorized to do whatever one wanted to do, but belief that one must not do something that was being advocated at the time.
Yeah, there are really a lot of examples of this that come from reformers. So women's rights activists in the 19th century who, you know, wanted to expand women's political rights used this kind of language and scriptural defenses for women's rights. This happens around anti-slavery and abolitionism. What does it mean to be in covenant with God? What does Scripture teach us? Now, there were huge debates about what the Bible said about slavery. So there are people arguing on both sides of this issue. You know, what is God's will for the nation? There definitely are many episodes where chosenness comes with responsibility and sacrifice, as well as a kind of celebration of we can do whatever we want to do. I think you can especially see this during the Civil War. I decided not to talk about Lincoln because he could take up the entire talk. But there were many ministers during the Civil War arguing about slavery and also about the legitimacy of killing other Americans who are using these kinds of ideas about what it means to be God's covenant people.
Are there any leaders who, prominent people who changed their mind based on scriptural or theological argument?
It's a good question. I hope that many religious leaders changed their minds about slavery in the 19th century. There were certainly Protestants with more conservative leanings in the late 19th century, someone like Dwight Moody, for example, who became convinced that women's rights were God's will, based on scriptural arguments made by people like Francis Willard.
Karen, you're up next. Why don't you pull the mic over there? And then Dale.
And again, thank you so much. This was extraordinary. So you describe Winthrop as laying out this basically communitarian collectivist vision, labor and suffer together, members of the same body. But by 200 years later, you have Tocqueville describing this as a country where the, you know, central driving principle is individualism and self-interest. Mm-hmm. And I think the earliest way of describing American exceptionalism was that was what made us different from Europe. So how does that sort of evolution take place from this country being sort of founded on collectivism to being, you know, driven by individualism and self-interest, and that, in fact, being the very basic definition of freedom in the American sense?
Mm-hmm. So this is a very big question. The book that I hope to write after this book is about Christianity and capitalism, and I think part of the answer lies there. The Puritans had a very communal vision. They actually set prices and wages in the early years of their settlement. A merchant couldn't charge, you know, whatever he wanted to charge. They decided what was sort of a fair price. I think that part of the impetus for the rise of a kind of distinctive American individualism does come from market developments. It comes from people pursuing their own economic interests. You can see this even in the Puritan era, where there's a famous trial of somebody named Robert Kane, who was a member of the First Church of Boston, who was accused of charging too much for his goods, and he was brought in front of the church, and he was actually excommunicated, and he sort of shrugged and said, I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm not bound by this discipline anymore. So I think part of the answer for this comes from market conditions, but I think that looking for the roots of American individualism, you would have to look not only at the market, but on the influence of Enlightenment ideas about the sort of autonomous individual being the most important entity. You would have to look at the rise of Democratic or small r Republican ideas about politics, in which you know, each person has a vote. So this is a kind of confluence of political, economic, and religious factors as well. There's a kind of individualistic strain, I think, even in Puritanism, in terms of people claiming that maybe they can have direct revelations from God, and that puts spiritual authority in the individual and not in the community. This was considered heretical at the time, but it gained greater acceptance.
Thanks. You're up. Pull the mic over, please. And then Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm. Two completely different questions. One is about the images with Washington going to heaven, this woman in the flowing gown, and how whether there's sort of like tracks that of that age where it's about the country and how wonderful the country is or its leaders as opposed to the gospel. I'm just wondering how much weight those images had. And then I also wondered about what you said about Phyllis Wheatley and Maria Stewart, and whether those voices were influential in any way, how that compared to the King's words. And the other thing that made me think of was Frederick Douglass, who mm-hmm. questioned, you know, July 4th celebrations.
Right. Right. So these images were really very popular. You can find them. You can find them in so many different places. So, you know, including on plates and mugs. Here's the other one. I do think these ideas were popular. I think it's not just, you know, a matter of the elite. If you go to the Capitol and look up at the dome, you'll see this was during the Civil War, you'll see this kind of frightening image of Washington where he really looks like almost like a Moses figure. So I think this idea that the founders were, you know, somehow divinely inspired or were doing God's will was fairly widespread. And I think has really become even more influential today with some people like David Barton. I don't know if any of you are familiar with him, where I have to say that there are a lot of historical inaccuracies in the work of somebody like David Barton, and I think deliberate misrepresentations. But the suggestion has been that when the founders were writing the Constitution, that they were directly inspired by the Holy Spirit. There's a story that often gets told in evangelical homeschooling books that the founders were deadlocked. They had been trying to write the Constitution, and then Benjamin Franklin stood up and said, I think what we need to do is to start every day with prayer. It turns out that this part is true. It's very odd. Franklin was odd. It was old at the time. It was sort of an odd request for him to make, but he did. But what the evangelical homeschooling books don't tell you is that the Continental Congress decided to table his motion, and nothing happened with it. But usually the way the story gets told in these conservative texts is that Franklin made this plea, and then all of a sudden the Constitution almost wrote itself, that everybody could agree. And so I think this is a more extreme version of what you're seeing in this image, where there are Christians who think that you know, not only was the Bible inspired by God, but the Constitution was inspired by God. And this, I think, explains some of the focus on originalism for Christian conservatives. On the question of somebody like Phyllis Wheatley, Maria Stewart, their voices were certainly not as influential as the voices of white Americans at the time that they wrote. But I think what we can see through them is a kind of minority report on ways to understand American chosenness that was held within black churches. Black churches began organizing really in secret, even in the late 18th century and certainly into the 19th century. And I think these ideas were prevalent within black religious spaces. And so when you get to civil rights, you're actually hearing, I think, a long strain of black Christian thinking about what the Republic meant. So I think Phyllis Wheatley and Maria Stewart were kind of, you know, curiosities at the time. But I think their ideas were influential among Black Americans.
We had Al Robito here making those very points.
Yes.
About a year and a half ago. It was terrific. I call your attention to that transcript. It was one of the most powerful presentations we've ever had. Let me just quickly say about David Barton, you know, to their credit, you'll want maybe not know this, that the evangelical publisher Thomas Nelson,
yes,
pulled his book,
I know,
at the critique of the evangelical historian at Baylor, mm-hmm, of his view of Jefferson.
Yeah.
And then Nelson pulled Barton's potentially best-selling book. It created quite a little firestorm. Anyway, just an anecdote to the side there. Elizabeth, you're up next. Pull the mic up.
Thank you so much. It's really helpful in the middle of this national moment to just stop and think about history, so thank you. I'm curious about when you mentioned the similarity in language between the KKK and Martin Luther King, and I think, okay, so that the photo was 1925, and then 30, 40 years later, the Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King's different but yet similar use of that language. Then almost 30 years later, you mentioned that religious right has been the most effective in using this language of chosenness now, which sort of swings back the other way. So we're about 30 years since then, and I'm curious, where are you seeing use of chosenness language now on the left? Where did you see that during Barack Obama's presidency? And you flicked at it very quickly with the Hillary Clinton slide. But what touchstones are you looking at now in evaluating, are we going to swing, or is there a groundswell of that in other places?
Mm-hmm. So Barack Obama definitely used this language. It was when he was talking about Syria. I'm trying to remember what year this was, that he described America as being exceptional and having a responsibility on the world stage. I'm not sure where, to be honest, I'm really not sure where this language is going now. I don't know whether Trump will change his mind and decide that he wants to embrace this language himself. Let me see if I can find the slide. I thought I would. Well, we know he'll change his mind. I just wanted to show you if I can find it. I had a slide of, at his inauguration, Paula White used this kind of language, even though he himself did not. So, you know, I think there's a potential for him to decide to reclaim this, but I think it also exists on the left, and the question is whether they will, decide that they really want to try, here she is, whether they really want to try to revitalize this tradition or not. Historians are really bad at predicting the future, but I do find it still on both sides, but I think that since Ronald Reagan, it really has been more the property of the right, even though before Reagan used this image at CPAC in 1974, John F. Kennedy had used this image of America as a city on a hill in a speech that he gave in Massachusetts shortly before his inauguration. And for whatever reason, his use of the language didn't seem to take off in the way that Reagan's did. Reagan somehow used it more effectively. But Kennedy, too, was attracted to this image. So I do think it's consensus language. I do think it's used by both sides, and that's part of the reason it's so powerful. But I think it's been employed more successfully on the right in recent years than on the left. Do you have any thoughts about this?
I'm more curious to hear yours at this point, but I'd just be curious if there's any other ways. How do you mark the efficacy of Obama's use of that language? It seemed like it was maybe going to be effective in this new kind of way, but it would have to allow, I guess, different. broadening of the term, and it's hard to know now how effective that's going to be.
Well, I'm not sure that Obama used it so effectively that he stole it back for the left, if that's your question. I think that there was still the sense that his commitment to the United States was not genuine, you know, that he was not as patriotic. So I don't think that he sort of effectively swung it in a different direction.
Miranda, pull the mic over. You're up next. But let me just say, that leave the Paula White. We're going to be dealing with her tomorrow morning, Kate. Has written an entire book about what Paula White believes. We'll be dealing with
this slide was for Kate. I added it at the end.
We invited Paula White, but I didn't get a reply to her email. So anyway, just kidding. Miranda Kennedy is up, and then we're going to be taking a break in a moment.
Well, this is related to Elizabeth's thoughts, but I was wondering how you see the language of Christian identity playing out in today's kind of new movements on the right. So with the kind of traditional Christian right losing some of its power in our politics, I wonder, like, do you see that in the alt-right at all? Or those similar movements?
So when you're saying Christian identity, are you talking broadly, or are you talking about the movement known as Christian identity, which is a kind of white nationalist
movement?
No, I'm
talking broadly.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I just want to make sure. Sorry, repeat.
Yeah.
repeat the question.
So just how do you see the idea of the America's identity as a Christian identity playing out in the new movements on the right?
Yeah. So I do think that if we look more broadly across American culture, that we do have this new language of American exceptionalism, which seems to me like a repackaging of Christian ideas in a language that's more accessible to the N-O-N-E-S, the nuns, and to people who are not Christian. But I do think that Christian conservatives are still very invested in this more explicitly Christian understanding of the nation. And I think that Donald Trump is being pressured by some of those conservatives to turn the United States into a more explicitly Christian place. So for a long time, there have been Christian conservatives who want a constitutional amendment saying that the United States is a Christian nation. I would not be at all surprised to see that emerge again. That's had a kind of recurring history ever since actually the end of the Civil War. There were Christians after the Civil War who believed that the Civil War was the result of God being angry with them. And why was God angry? God was not angry about slavery. God was angry that Christianity was not in the Constitution. And so they wanted a constitutional amendment. So I do think that Christian conservatives today are still invested in this idea that America is a Christian nation, and they have a sense of they feel as if they've been robbed of something, that you know, Christianity has been taken out of the public sphere, and that America is no longer, you know, the United States of the 1950s under President Eisenhower, you know, who added the words "under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. They want that back. They really feel bereft.
So when you say Christian conservatives, I mean, who do you mean? I just wonder who these people are, and I don't see them like in the public eye the way they were in past generations as much, or leading our politics.
That's interesting, because I guess because I'm looking at them, because I'm paying attention to them, I feel as if they are still very much, they're still very active. I would say places like Liberty University, I think Focus on the Family is still a force to be reckoned with. I think there are a number of influential Christian ministers, including somebody like Rick Warren, who spoke at Barack Obama's inauguration, who have strong political convictions about what the nation should be. But I think that the term Christian conservative is, this is a very broad term that can be could be divided up into a lot of different ways. And I know that, Kate will talk about this more with, you know, where do the prosperity gospel preachers fall in relationship to, for example, the Southern Baptist Convention. So this is not a singular category by any means. But I do think it's still a potent category. I think there's something else that's happening, though, as well, which is that when I was reading about the election and there was a lot of polling done about, you know, who is going to vote for whom, and I think that there are some political conservatives now who started identifying themselves as evangelicals who are not really very seriously Christian. I think when people have gone out and done polling and said, who are you going to vote for and how do you identify yourself religiously, there has been such a synergy between political and religious conservatism that political conservatives tend to identify themselves as evangelicals, even if the sort of markers that I would use, you know, as a scholar for what makes an evangelical doesn't apply, you know, like biblical literalism, for example, or even frequent church going. There was a really odd survey of, you know, a certain number of a percentage of evangelicals were going to be voting for Trump. And, you know, some of them went to church once a year. And I'm thinking that's not an evangelical.